Today is February 9th, and I'm back with Bill Weiss in his office at Stanford for the third and final part of his Pew interview. Yesterday, you talked quite a lot about collaborations and also a little bit about competition in the workplace, and I wanted to explore that just a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because it sounded like when you first went into this field, it was something that not too many people were interested in, and then it became very hot after
right.
a while. So, kind of in a global sense, how do you see competition impacting the study of science?
Well, I think there are obvious positives and negatives. The obvious positives are that people are human and are, to some extent, competitive, and to the extent that it actually spurs people to do things, it can be a motivation. And many people function like that. The downside is that many people crumble under such competition, so it goes both ways. The obvious downsides is that it's globally inefficient. If two labs are working on the same thing, then resources are being put into the same thing instead of two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, that's just the reality of how things work, and I wouldn't defend it. I mean, I think if everyone really got along and could be sufficiently motivated just by the work itself and not have the extra spur of competition, you know, things would be better, but that's the way it works. And of course, the competition is, there are external forces that I think come into that competition. It's not just people's egos, although that's certainly part of it. It's things like, well, if I don't get this done, I'm going to lose my grant, because I've written a grant to do this, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in structural biology, it's a real problem, because so much of what we do has, the very long-term projects was basically one payoff, a structure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, there's no second place in something like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
you might go on and do some good, clever, you know, studies after that, but it's particularly devastating in this field to be second
mm-hmm.
If it's really the same molecule that's being studied.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of thing is a problem. So as I said, I mean, I think I'm someone who actually doesn't particularly like the competition, but I also recognize that from time to time it's probably spurred us on to do things more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily better, but more
mm-hmm.
quickly. And unfortunately, the system does in part reward speed rather than thoughtfulness in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, a lot of my colleagues do thrive on it. Not all, but there are definitely people who do get a rush out of, you know, there's definitely a rush in working on things like that. It's not an attraction of it for me, and as I said, one of the reasons I went into this sort of an attraction of sort of structural biology when I started in it was that it was very much non-competitive and cooperative the way it is not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'd do it again. Well, I probably would, but, it, you know, I'd probably give it more thought.
Mm-hmm.
At least that positive aspect of it wouldn't
mm-hmm.
be there anymore
mm-hmm.
if I was starting out again.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned in your own work that you got scooped once, and or more than once.
it's happened a couple of times.
A couple times.
One major thing, but
How was that? I mean, that sounds pretty disappointing.
Yeah, it was very disappointing, but it wasn't unexpected. I mean, what happens is that this was a case where there was an obvious target. Four labs were working on it, it turned out. I found out three other labs also got beaten.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't alone. You just move on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a lot. I mean, I actually, you know, I have sort of now a track record, and the people I actually worry about far more are the people who are really in the trenches doing the work. In that case, the postdoc doing that project had to move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's far more devastating for them. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's where it really impacts more. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're the postdoc or student doing it and you get scooped, sort of for me personally, it's less of an issue. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it impacts grants and the like.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it wasn't a disaster. But I really worry much more about them, and that's why I really try to avoid it and try to work it out if I know we've got competition, because that's a far more important thing.
Well, what happens to a you know, a student who's, you know, this is going to be his dissertation, and yeah. suddenly it's old news.
Right, right. Well, then it depends if there are clever follow-up things. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes what happens is that people are working on related things, but they're not the same, mm-hmm. and then the comparisons turn out to be quite interesting. It's quite often that second paper that mm-hmm. can be the more interesting one. Mm-hmm. That happens. If it's really the identical thing, then it's really a matter of whether you're better positioned, say, than the competitor to kind of move on and do, you know, the follow-up work and the studies, and you know, mm-hmm. salvaging something maybe is too negative a word, but I mean, at some level, mm-hmm. that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It depends. I've never really been in that situation where someone's been so. I mean, this postdoc was an example, but he's now working on other things and he's doing fine. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's just something that you have to deal with on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would never keep people in the dark about it. If, you know, people in the lab need to know that this is an issue. Sure. And some of them actually do get motivated by it. but it's just something you have to deal with, and it's not a good thing. It really isn't. And mm-hmm. we've been very lucky because the two of the three areas we work in, really, we've never had significant competition. We've gotten scooped on little things here and there, never any major. The other thing has been very competitive, mm-hmm. and it's the first time I've really experienced being in this situation. Mm-hmm. I've been on the other end of it a few times where we've really kind of, you know, beaten other people. People were, you know, and where we legitimately didn't know there was competition. I mean, it wasn't that mm-hmm. we did anything intentional, but we just didn't realize, you know, someone else was working on it until it was basically in hand. That's happened a couple of times. So I really haven't been, with this one exception, on the bad end of it very often. Mm-hmm. But it's always there, and I think it's only getting worse mm-hmm. in this field. But, you know, the people who do cell and molecular biology with the time scales of projects is much shorter, this is something everyone lives with.
Mm-hmm. Now, do people ever, you know, try to... Well, I guess this is my editorial. Be courteous and co-publish if they know someone else is really.
Yeah, well,
awesome.
In fact, we in the same project where we got mm-hmm. beaten, the lab, Axel Brunger's lab that we were competing against, we have simultaneously published two absolutely identical structures, the mm-hmm. two labs. The mm-hmm. first time it happened, we literally didn't know the other was working on this particular molecule. The second time, we did know. And they were a little bit ahead of us, and so, you know, I talked to him, said, well, look, you know, I just don't want anyone to get hurt, because no one got hurt, because everything mm-hmm. came out at the same time, and it was fine. And I asked them if they would be interested in co-publishing, and they decided not to do that. I said, you know, we were clearly behind them by a little while. And they chose, you know, they didn't want to do that, but in the end, we were able to get it submitted about three or four weeks after them, and it wound up being accepted before this came out, so there was no problem again, mm-hmm. so at least we were communicating there, I still think it would have been better if they had agreed to slow down, but that's their choice, you know, and they chose sure. not to. But in the end, it was fine, because, again, all the papers did come out about the same time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, it seems to me that there is potential in a very competitive system for people to cut corners and
oh, sure.
not always behave, let's say, in the most ethical fashion.
Oh, yeah, and you hear about such things.
Have you run into that in your...
Personally, no. No. Also, what we do, we're doing X-ray structures, for example, is... There is an answer, basically, okay? Uh-huh. And you can't really cut corners. You either have it right or you don't. Mm-hmm. There have been cases where people have made minor mistakes because they were in a rush. I know of other competitive situations, mm-hmm. not me personally, but, you know, in labs I've been in, and people got a little sloppy and things. But fundamentally, they had the right answer. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that's always a worry. And of course, you hear about this in other. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not in a field where we could fabricate data, certainly. I mean, there's never, mm-hmm. There can't be that kind of outright fraud. It's just impossible. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of what we do. But, yeah, I think there have been some sloppy things. And even, you know, for myself, the fact is, you know, these things that we knew we had competition on, we We probably wrote that paper a little faster than I would have liked to, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to think about mm-hmm. some of the implications. But in the end, we got a nice piece of work out, and you know, it was fine. But you know, so I think for me personally, I think we probably do sacrifice a bit of rigor, perhaps, in thinking about the problem and analyzing it and writing the best paper possible. Mm-hmm. I think that definitely will get sacrificed in a situation like that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But you can't. But the data's.
The data are not the issue there. Yeah, yeah. It's just sort of the presentation and the analysis thereof. You know, mm-hmm. that's more of a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me a little bit, because you all, you know, the flip side of competition is collaboration,
sure.
and it sounds as if, from what we spoke about yesterday, that you've had a number of very fruitful.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, it is one of the things about, particularly when I started in this, it's not quite as true now, but it's a very technically complex area, X-ray mm-hmm. crystallography, working out three-dimensional atomic structures. And we are, at some level, you know, tradesmen or craftsmen, specialists, whatever you want to call it, that a lot of people, you know, don't know how to do. There's a long time investment in learning how to mm-hmm. do this. The flip side of it is that we are not as, at least of my generation, where we really invested years in just learning the methods because they were really being developed still. Most of us are not as well-rounded biologists, say. I mean, we're really on the most physical reductionist end of the mm-hmm. biomedical research spectrum. And you know, I'm absolutely fascinated with various problems in cell membrane biology. That's what we work on. But I'm not a cell biologist. I would never claim to be. And so having collaborations with such people, it's much more, in a good collaboration, it's much more than the sum of the parts. You really, mm-hmm. it really is synergistic, and that's the ideal thing, and it's very mm-hmm. stimulating, both from purely abstract intellectual level, just talking with colleagues and people in their lab, mm-hmm. learning a lot of from them, and, you know, we, I think, you know, give that to them as well, in the other direction. And it's actually one of the most enjoyable things for me, is that kind of interaction. And these collaborations really have run the gamut. So our work on the C-type lectins that we do with Kurt Drickamer is very much, it's really close. I mean, they do a lot of the molecular biology and some of the protein work, and we do the X-ray work and some of the protein work, and you know, we really have a very close collaboration. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's more our work on the catenins. We have a collaboration with James Nelson, which is really all the sort of practical stuff's been done in my lab, but as we've been accumulating the structural data, but now we're in a position, we talk to James a lot and just sort of about the biology of things, and we're now going to be in the future in a position to go back, take our results and our models and go back into cells with their lab, which is their expertise, mm-hmm. and really do things, and it's certainly going to be far better than anything we could do by ourselves. And part of that is it's a matter of personality. There are people who really want to have total, you know, they're control freaks.
Yeah.
They want to have, you know, a complete control over it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I understand there are egos involved in this, but I just kind of want to sort of see the problem solved. And I actually really take away a lot from the interactions with colleagues. So I really like that kind of collaborative environment. I think it just varies for different people, the degree mm-hmm. to which they do that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've had some pretty bad ones where people have said, oh, we should do this, and then we'll give you molecules to try to work with to crystallize, mm-hmm. and then they decide, oh, this is actually pretty expensive and pretty time-consuming for us to be doing, and then they've just dropped it. So we've had mm-hmm. bad ones as well, mm-hmm. and I've learned to be very careful about, you know, who to collaborate with and the mm-hmm. like. So you just don't know sometimes, of course. But by and large, I've been very, very happy with, you know, things have worked out really well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your current work, because mm-hmm. you said yesterday that you have sort of three different things going, three grants, three areas, three projects. So maybe you can kind of fill me in a little bit on what's going on in your work.
Okay, so the oldest one, which is the stuff that, as I said, dated back to my postdoc, is mm-hmm. this family of carbohydrate binding proteins called C-type lectins, and the C means they're calcium dependent. That's just how the family is named. Mm-hmm. And these are molecules So in basically all eukaryotes, the cell surface proteins and actually in prokaryotes too, of course, cell walls are have carbohydrate modifications. And it turns out that those are used as molecular recognition determinants. Okay, so a couple of examples. When white blood cells traffic through the body and they go from the blood into the lymphatic system, they have to get out in through specialized tissues. And that happens through an interaction. It's a multi-step process, but where the cells are being zipping along in the blood and then they hit these tissues and they start, it's actually a remarkable phenomenon. They actually start tumbling along the endothelial walls. And that interaction, that tumbling, is actually mediated by this interaction of these this family of proteins. They're called selectins, the particular family members. And they interact with specific carbohydrate structures that are expressed on those cells. And that slows them down and they start tumbling. And then that induces other adhesion molecules and eventually they stop. They get stopped dead and then they crawl out between. It's really a remarkable process. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of one of the things that happens. I got into this actually through my graduate work with Don Wiley because in the virus, I mentioned hemagglutinin, the hemagglutinin protein on the flu virus binds to carbohydrates in your respiratory endothelium. That's how it attaches to cells and gets in and infects. Another group of molecules that do this that we also study in the C-type lectin family are proteins found both in the serum and on macrophages that recognize, you exploit the fact that pathogenic organisms have sugar structures on the surfaces that are different from us, and it's a way of distinguishing a foreign from a self independent of an antibody response. It's called primitive immunity. Mm-hmm. And we're basically looking at all these molecules and try to understand in a detailed chemical molecular sense how they actually specifically recognize certain carbohydrates. That's a that's been a long-standing effort to understand this family. And then there are other aspects of that family. A lot of them turn out to be endocytic receptors, which means that they, let's say these macrophage receptors, they will actually bind, say, a bug at a cell surface, and endocyte and phagocytose it for for destruction. And these receptors take their cargo in and then into a vesicle, an invagination on the surface, which pinches off to form a vesicle, and then the vesicle is delivered to a particular area like a lysosome to get destroyed, and the receptor actually recycles to the surface. So there's this this reversible transit where it binds, has to release, and then go back. And that release in this family and actually many receptors is mediated by pH because these vesicles that get pinched off get acidified. And one of the things we've been studying is the mechanism by which the... And that turns out, in turn, to be related to this calcium dependence of binding. The acid actually titrates the calcium off the structure. And it turns out to induce changes in the protein structure, and we're basically been trying to understand how all that works, both in terms of structure and thermodynamics and kinetics. So that's one of the areas we study. So we were, I was working on this when I came here, and then I had this interest generally in cell adhesion. And when I moved here, I met James Nelson, and I got very interested. There's another class of adhesion molecules called cadherins. It's an abbreviation for calcium-dependent adhesion molecule. And these are so-called homophilic adhesion molecules. So these are transmembrane proteins that sit on cells and solid tissues. And they're the same flavor, they have lots of different kinds, and the same flavor of cadherin binds to itself on another cell. And this is what knits the same kind of cells together in a solid tissue. So, for example, when a liver is developing, cells differentiate into hepatocytes, and they express particular kind of cadherin, and then they know that they belong together in one solid tissue. It's a way multicellular organisms actually use to differentiate into specific, tissues, and I got very interested in that problem. And the specific thing we're doing, I said that in the case of these lectins, these carbohydrate binding proteins, we're looking at their extracellular portions and how they interact. Well, a number of labs, including Wayne Hendrickson, my old boss, had been looking at the extracellular domain of the cadherins and how they may interact. But I got interested in a different problem, and that is that the these molecules do not work unless they have an intact cytoplasmic domain. So on the inside of the cell, they have to have an intact cytoplasmic domain, which is actually very highly conserved. And that's because these have to be linked to the cytoskeleton. And so you imagine basically what these molecules do is you have a tissue full of the same kind of cell with rivets, which are basically these adhesion molecules, and then the sort of structural steel, the girders, are the cytoskeletons. And you have to have that whole network to form, to actually provide, you know, mechanical strength and integrity to tissues. And I got very interested in understanding how the cytoplasmic side of that's put together, because it turns out that a lot of the regulation of adhesiveness comes there. So, for example, in cancer, one of the things that happens when cells become metastatic and they have to get out of tissues, they have to de-adhere. They lose contact, so-called contact inhibition, and they get out, and these junctions have to fall apart, so the cells aren't adherent anymore. And not surprisingly, these assemblies are very highly regulated. So it turns out that the cytoplasmic domain of the cadherin is not linked directly to the cytoskeleton, but through proteins that are collectively called catenins, from the Latin to link. And we started studying these, and the goal of our work is basically to understand in biophysical terms how these cell junctions are assembled and how they're regulated. It turns out they're regulated by phosphorylation, most likely. We really want to understand how all this works, how they are put together, how phosphorylation affects them. And we started by looking at this molecule beta-catenin, which binds to the tails of cadherin, and then to another molecule called alpha-catenin, which is unrelated, which links it to actin. And there are lots of other proteins involved, but that's kind of the linkage. And we started working on this, and what happened, and we've been continuing to do this work, and I don't need to go into the details of that, but what happened, it was very interesting. So it shows you how you can just go in new directions in a sort of fortuitous way. Beta-catenin, when it was isolated and cloned around 1990, when it was cloned, it turned out to be a homologue of a Drosophila, a fruit fly protein, called armadillo. Okay, now armadillo was isolated in it's a so-called segment polarity gene. It affects the body plan during early embryogenesis of a fly larva. And no one understood what it did at that time. But everyone knew it was homologous to this structural component of a cell junction. And it turns out now in flies it does the same thing in junctions. And so everyone thought, well, maybe, at least I thought, what it might do is be directly involved in adhesion. When you develop multicellular organisms, tissue cells adhere and de-adhere, tissues remodel. But it turns out that it has a completely separate role as well. And it turns out to be true in invertebrates, which is that it is one of the downstream effectors of a growth factor signaling pathway that controls cell fate determination in embryogenesis. So not only is it a structural component of cell junctions, which is how we got into it, but it's a developmental signaling molecule. So that's gotten us into looking at that pathway as well, which is actually very complex, and we're looking at interactions in that system as well and trying to understand how it functions there. So that, starting from the cell adhesion, it got us into this whole interest of signaling networks and developmental signaling pathways. So we're working in that area. We've kind of gotten, happily dragged into it, but it's not what we started. And that's a lot of fun because it's, I've learned a tremendous amount of stuff I knew nothing about, and now it's really a main, becoming a real, really a big part of the lab. And then the last area we're working on is on intracellular vesicle trafficking, and basically in all eukaryotic cells, cargo gets moved around, say from the endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi, through the Golgi apparatus, Golgi to plasma membrane to lysosome, whatever, or conversely, endocytosed vesicles have to move to particular places. And what happens is that cargo gets delivered, and these vesicles have to get targeted specifically to a membrane and then dock and fuse so that the contents of their lumen gets dumped into the next compartment. And there's a whole machinery that controls that, not surprisingly. And I was very interested in this from Don Wiley's lab, actually, because of the fact that influenza does, and other viruses like HIV, get into cells through this membrane fusion mechanism. And I was really interested in how that works. And so when I came here, we started collaborating with Richard Scheller, who's one of the main people in this field. And we've been working together on trying to understand some of the molecules involved in that process. So those are the sort of three main areas we're involved with. We have a fourth thing, which is really mostly happening in Collaborators Lab on, actually harkens back to undergraduate days, is our interest in 7-helix receptors and rhodopsin, which is that one of my colleagues, Brian Kobilka, is also in the MCP department.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Brian Kobilka, K-O-B-I-L-K-A.
Okay.
Who works on beta-adrenergic receptors, or generally adrenergic receptors, and he's been very interested in trying to get structural information, so we're working with him to try to get structure. These are integral membrane proteins, so it's a very hard, as I mentioned the other day, it's a very challenging problem. Mostly, actually, at the level of expressing enough protein to work with at the quantities we need, and we've been working with him, you know, trying to, you know, work on this and, you know, get enough and try to crystallize it. And eventually, that's going to tie into other things we're doing because, for example, the in the signaling pathways, a lot of times there are 7-helix receptors. You know, these are representative of a much broader class of receptors, and so you know, a lot of these things are going to tie into one another over time. But it's all, you know, everything we're doing is ultimately cell membrane biology in the most general sense. That's really the interest of the lab.
Now, yesterday you said that the Pew money, in particular, allowed you to do something that you wouldn't have otherwise done.
Yeah.
Which of these?
I wrote it actually on the Cadherin-Katinin project.
Right.
Yeah, that was the main thing. But that's how I justified the request for the money. No, and it's true. I mean, you know, that was it. And then. I also certainly used it also with this Howard Hughes support, you know, that junior faculty grant to work on the vesicle stuff as well. Although that in part has been, you know, because Richard Schiller has contributed a technician, you know, to this early on. So, and we have kind of a joint postdoc between us now. So that's been sort of more integrated in terms of the financial support as well. But particularly the Cadherin-Katinin stuff was really... That just wouldn't have happened without the Pew.
Well, the things that you're working on right now, and I know there are different things, so this may not be a simple answer, but how are these things going to contribute to our understanding of cellular...
Cell biology
mechanisms.
Well, I think again, you know, structural biology, biophysical mechanism. This is really, again, at the most reductionist end of biochemistry. Can you take a system apart and really understand it at the level of chemistry and physics? And that means understanding specificity. Say in the lectin case, you know, what are the atomic determinants that allow these molecules to only selectively recognize pathogenic cell surfaces and not our own. So you're only killing the right target. So specificity is one thing. You know, really understanding biological specificity at a very chemical level. Mechanism as well. You know, what is the mechanism by which this machinery that fuses membranes, how does that all work? How do these proteins come together to work? How do you set up a regulatory system? How do you target specifically... And the like, and you know, and a lot, and that's a question that has to be approached at whole cell levels, you know, biochemical, you know, genetic, structural, but you know, we're contributing in that global picture, trying to really understand it at that basic level. In the case of the cadherins, it's really again trying to understand why you have to, you know, the nature of these cell junction assemblies, and that includes both how do these things bear loads, you know, what I'd love to do with this, and this is what I'm planning on doing once we have some basic structural information, is basically reconstruct a cell junction in an artificial system to the point where we can actually, in a controlled way, exert forces on single assemblies and really understand the mechanical loads. This is just fundamental to understanding why tissues are strong or not, and, you know, how you how you strengthen or not strengthen tissues. And again, the regulatory mechanisms, if you know phosphorylation affects these, how does phosphorylation of some of these proteins affect their interactions quantitatively? What does it do to the structures? What does it do to their binding affinities? So very, very basic level information. That, you know, that's really what I'm interested in. You know, those are the kinds of ways that they contribute to that field. You know, and in the best case structure really does, and I'm not saying it's going to happen in all these, but I think particularly in the Katinan system it will, it really does, can give such a new way of looking at things. I think, it can really bring understanding to a level. There are sort of two kinds of structural biology. One is kind of, okay, kind of all the biochemical parameters, and you kind of know how the system works, and you're filling in a lot of details. And I don't actually find that interesting to do. It's not that it's a perfectly valid thing to do, and for certain practical things, if you're worried about, drug design, for example, that can be a very practical thing. You have to know those details. But I'm more interested in problems where, we just take a totally different view of the world from, say, a cell biologist, where we start from structure and try to gain some insight into how it might work and then go back up and try to really see where the biology may come from. Okay, and it's kind of a different approach, and I think it's not any more or less valid, it's just a different way, and we can bring that and really be, to the problem and bring, complement what, say, the cell biologists are doing. Mm-hmm. And that's where the most fun stuff happens. And, of course, there have been some spectacular examples. Of the most obvious impact of structure, I would say, in the last 20 years was in Don Wiley's lab, this DMHC, the structure of the histocompatibility antigens, where seeing that molecule and this peptide bound in that groove, you just got an insight into how T-cell recognition worked and how you generate T-cell responses. That, that was one of the most spectacular examples. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of it is fortuitous timing. That came along at exactly the right time to where the immunological research mm-hmm. is, and sometimes it's incredibly synergistic. More often than not, things are a bit out of sync, but I like to be out of sync at the level of where we don't know quite so much about the biology, and you try to bring it to a new mechanistic level.
Yeah. So. Well, you actually light up when you talk about this stuff. I can see it's very exciting for you. Now, what about practical applications? I mean, we know about the histocompatibility things. That's kind of, everybody knows about that now. But what kinds of practical applications could you see coming from this?
Well, the lectins are an example where, for example, with the selectins, I'll tell you the ups and downs of this.
Okay.
A lot of people are interested, the issue of specificity in designing inhibitors mm-hmm. Is one that is broadly, in theory, applicable. In other words, if you knew atomic structures and you knew something about how to make new synthetic molecules, in principle, one could design something that will fit and have the right shape, fit into an enzyme or a target, and mm-hmm. act as a rationally designed inhibitor. And, in fact, when selectins were discovered, around the time we solved our structure, several companies wanted our coordinates because they wanted to try to understand these interactions. Mm-hmm. And that's a very practical use of crystallography. Now, in fact, it was a real interest of mine when I was in Don's lab, thinking about, we worked out the receptor interaction, sialic acid receptor interaction with hemagglutinin, mm-hmm. and say, boy, mm-hmm. drug design. And it was kind of early days then, and it wasn't clear how it was going to pan out, but frankly, it's been a pretty big disappointment, and it's really due to a fundamental thing, which is that we know a lot about atomic structure, but the link between atomic structure and thermodynamics, because ultimately the problem is you have to make something that binds more tightly, mm-hmm. has the right thermodynamic, forgetting bioavailability and all that other stuff that comes into it, which is critical, of course. Fundamental thing is you want to be able to design something that binds more tightly, displaces the natural ligand, to act as an inhibitor. And there is a fundamental lack of understanding between structure and thermodynamics. That's the realm of statistical mechanics. And that is just not a sufficiently developed area, theoretically, to allow you to do that in a good way. And there's a lot of really smart people working on that problem. Mm-hmm. But it's been disappointingly slow, the progress in that, actually, because mm-hmm. it's very hard for many, many reasons. So there actually have not been, there have been a couple of spectacular success stories with structure-based design. The influenza neuraminidase inhibitor, the anti-flu drugs that have just come out, HIV protease inhibitors are a really spectacular example, because there was a lot of knowledge about protease inhibitors and proteases that led to that. So that, you know, those are important applications.
But there was a dismal failure too, because I remember in the early days of HIV, people were trying to prevent adhesion of the virus to the cell wall by giving soluble CD4.
And that was the target, right? Yeah, that's right. That wasn't the kind of rational design I'm talking about, because that was based on a known biochemical property. You knew CD4 bound to it. Can you just inhibit the interaction? Uh-huh. Okay. This is stuff where you're designing molecules knowing atomic structure, designing small molecule inhibitors to stuff up an interaction. And the lectins have their own peculiarities, which, you know, basically make it almost, you know, a very, very hard problem, and that's why all the drug companies bailed on it, actually, to make anti-inflammatories, or it seems that they have. But that has been, it still is a big area. All the drug companies have crystallographers and people doing modeling and the like, but it has actually not been a success in the sense that, gee, I know the structure, I can design a molecule. Where it is very useful, though, and I do believe in it at this level, which is that if you think about the old days of screening for drugs, you would take a random, you know, a huge number of molecules, take a number, a million, okay, and you basically have to screen them, okay, to see what works. And I think what, at a minimum, what structure will give you is a way of reducing the number of things you have to look at. So you won't find the answer, but you might, if you can even reduce your search from a million to 10,000, you've done a huge, you've got a huge gain there. And I think that kind of thing is very important. And I think the methods, I'm actually optimistic, you know, that the methods will get better and better for this kind of rational design, but it's certainly not there yet. But this, and in combination with a lot of combinatorial chemistry, those new methods that have been developed, I think I'm very optimistic that that's going to happen. So those are kind of practical applications, and knowing molecular structure is just an integral part of that kind of inhibitor design process. It remains to be seen how, you know, widely successful it is, but I think it'll happen. But it's not something that, I must say, it's not something that practical stuff is really not what motivates me personally, but I recognize it as an application, sure.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned that sounds like somebody ought to be working on is this business of preventing metastatic events from happening. Is that in the pipeline with any of the companies?
Well, I don't, you know, that's really out of my area of expertise. Yeah. I don't know. I can imagine it. And I think, again, if we really, I would hope that if we got to the bottom of how these de-adhesion events happen, molecularly, that may be at least a new avenue to explore in terms of drugs. But I must say, I really am very, I just don't know. I mean, we all know all the, most of the anti-cancer drugs these days are basically aimed at inhibiting, just the growth, essentially. It's more, DNA targets and the like. I mean, that would be a wonderful new avenue if that comes to pass. It would be great if we contribute to that in some way. I could see it happening, but it remains to be seen.
Now, if something like that, I noticed, or at least you didn't put any on your resume, any patents.
No, we don't.
You don't have any. But, if something were to develop out of something that you discovered, And quite a few of the scholars do hold patents. Do you have any interest in that sort of thing, or?
I guess if it came to pass, I would probably be interested I would have to see. I mean, I'm not really motivated by money or anything, so I guess I'm just not. I guess if someone else was going to profit from my idea, I'd probably want to do it just in principle. it's not something I've really ever given much thought to, frankly. If it comes to pass, sure, I guess I would. But at a minimum, I think it would be great to be. I mean, what often happens, of course, with these things is that, patent or not, you wind up sort of consulting with companies that are doing the more practical development, and I think that would actually be very interesting, to actually see the science applied that way, and I would love to be involved with it at that level. It remains to be seen. I mean, one of the things, at least one of the main things we do, of course, is molecular structure, and, that's, despite I think certain people's desires, I feel it's not a patentable thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're basically looking at natural molecules and how they work. From time to time, I've heard rumors of people talking about patenting structures, but I think that's sort of not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I hope it doesn't.
Well, people patent genes.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's that same flavor, you know. Right. I'm really a believer in public dissemination of these things, but it remains to be seen what happens, I guess.
Well, it does, kind of bring up the question of who owns. Does anybody own scientific ideas?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I don't. I believe it is public domain. I mean, mm-hmm. I really believe that very strongly. And I think it's particularly. I think the ethics of it are very difficult when you talk about being supported by public money, particularly NIH money, to then turn around and do that. Mm-hmm. I guess it's a little stickier with, of course, with things discovered in companies, and it's one of the reasons I would never work in a company myself. But mm-hmm. I'm really a believer that that stuff should be public domain. Mm-hmm. I really do believe that. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that I think happens probably more than people realize in the sciences is this the role of, you can call it whatever you want, fate, serendipity.
Oh, yeah.
in scientific discovery. And, there are some really sort of classic historical examples of it, but... Has your work been affected by any serendipitous events?
That's a good question. No, not in the sense of a discovery that we've come on because of luck. I mean, we've had. It's kind of the nature of doing what we do, though. I mean, we take a problem and we. How do I put this? We take a problem and we kind of go at it in a fairly rational way, and we have the answer. Well, yeah, there can be some real surprises in the answer that we get out of an atomic structure. I mean, I've been surprised plenty of times, what the thing looks like and how you suddenly realize, oh, this is how it works. But that's not a chance discovery. I mean, in other words, we've gone ahead and sort of done the structural analysis mm-hmm. and then done it. So, and it's kind of the nature of our work that those things don't happen. We don't do so much of the kind of mixing things in test tubes and suddenly some odd result comes out. Well, I mean, we do a certain amount of that, and to the extent we do, that hasn't happened to us. Mm-hmm. But what can be lucky is... sort of the connections that have occurred, like this, as we were working on the beta-catenin problem and then all of a sudden learning about all this signaling stuff, it's the sort of, there's that element of chance that's taken us into this new direction of looking at mm-hmm. developmental signaling. So in sort of, there's been a real role of chance in the way sort of the lab and my interests have developed. You work on some kind of interesting molecule and it takes you into directions you really didn't anticipate. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And that's great. But in terms of making discoveries, no, that really hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Actually, let me flip over the tape here.